Welcome to another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk, part two of David F. Noble's 1997 book, The Religion of Technology, Penguin Books. Part two, I want to give some more specific quotes. And I also want to note that for some people who consider themselves religious, that I don't think the book is meant as an offense. It's rather pointing out the way that the religion is infused or put into areas where, say, we wouldn't necessarily need or expect it. So, like, for example, if you go to buy a product and you just want to buy the product, you're not interested in all the person's religion behind it. I mean, in a spiritual sense, I would like getting something that has somebody's consciousness and energy put into it. But, and you know, if I'm going to buy a gadget, it's not going to make much difference to me if the person was Christian, is Christian, Buddhist, atheist, whatever, if the gadget works. But I think in this book, he's conveying what's astounding is how much the religiosity gets mixed in with the motivation for the technology and the inventions, which throughout the history is dominated by the Judeo-Christian viewpoint. So that's one of the key aspects. And much of it has to do with relates to the modern times, with all we hear about the elites versus the lower classes. And here's a good example. This is a little bit of a lengthy section. This is about Francis Bacon. A lot of times these people that you've heard of throughout history that, you know, these great inventors and this and that. And then this book has been showing me like a different side of them. Like Galileo, he's quoted in this. And here's another quote before I get to that quote. The friars were monks who had abandoned the cloister in order to evangelize the world. As academic scholars, they laid the intellectual foundations for papal authority as well as science. And as missionaries, they lent religious sanction and support to papal and later imperial expansion. So there you have what for years I have summed up as theofascism. You have the papal, religious, imperial is the corporate and governmental, and the science, you know, that's mixed in there too. It's corporation, state, and religion all mixed up in there, which is really nothing new. And also he mentions this, like the Rosicrucians and the Freemasons, which various people I have read over the years have contributed some very interesting bits to culture and such like. I think I had read that Claude Debussy was a Rosicrucian, and another list of people like Newton with inventions, and yet some of the rituals coming from the Rosicrucians and the Freemasons are laced with this intense level of biblical Christianity and stuff that was, you know, in those cases very narrow-minded. So here's the longer quote. Bacon always located control of leadership in the millennial paradise firmly in elite hands. Likewise, in worldly affairs, he sought to enlarge human dominion over nature while preserving intact the established order. In an age of incessant social instability, as James R. Jacob observed, science became another means, along with work discipline and the reformation of manners, by which European elites, having distanced themselves from the people, sought to control and subject them to authority. Bacon himself disdained what he called the innate depravity and malignant disposition of the common people. He exhorted his peers to learn from lowly artisans, not to emulate them, but only to embrace their more exalted efforts. Galileo displayed a similar disdain for women and ordinary folk, the shallow minds of common people, those are quotes, and he urged the church to hide from the people scientific truth about the heavens, lest they become confused and troublesome. Bacon believed, however, that science would teach the peoples to take upon them the yoke of laws and submit to authority and forget their ungovernable appetites. Bacon's followers sustained this elitist outlook, though they earnestly envisioned the advent of an early millennium. Hartlib, Dury, Platts, and other early Baconians depended heavily upon parliamentary power and privileges and held to a rigidly hierarchical view of society. The Royal Society thus pooled talents and interests in order to benefit the elite and not the people. The mechanical philosophy and especially the Newtonian system served both church and state by providing a seeming naturalistic buttress to their inviolability of the established order. This legacy of the scientific revolution was perpetuated in the 18th century by the Newtonian Freemasons, science-minded aristocrats who combined mysticism and magic with a dedication to order, hierarchy, and perfectibility. So order and science and progress and with a sense of religion gets all mixed in there. And Wernher von Braun, who was the German Nazi who came to U.S., Operation Paperclip, the first rocket-powered missile from him, led to NASA and military spawning of artificial intelligence and space tech and on and on. And then he also mentions the hierarchy, the patriarchy, the male-dominated sciences and NASA and such like. And so there's this quote from a book about Kabbalah called The Ladder of Lights by William Gray. And he wrote, in the Genesis myth, it was man who fell and the seed of woman that brought redemption. So the whole sense of, the redemption word is tricky, but the whole sense of the feminine now being much more accentuated and the connection with the earth as a balancing of this male-dominated patriarchal in his image. You know, that's a male thing to say in his image rather than in God's image. What about in the spirit's image or in the multiplicity's image of the image of a tree, of a bee, the image of a sky, the image of clouds, the image of the interaction of now, how we've learned from science what natives have known for all along about how trees communicate underground. So again, I mentioned in what image. And the chapters always give an interesting flavor of the book. So I'll give the chapters are, it starts off part one, technology and transcendence, the divine likeness, millennium, the promise of perfection, visions of paradise, paradise restored, heavenly virtuosi, the new Adam and the new Eden. And part two, technologies of transcendence, Armageddon, atomic weapons, the ascent of the saints, space exploration, the immortal mind, artificial intelligence, powers of perfection, genetic engineering, and the politics of perfection. And with an appendix, a masculine millennium, a note on technology and gender. Chapter 1 starts, the dynamic project of Western technology, the defining mark of modernity, is actually medieval in origin and point. And this shift in the social status of the arts, if not the artisans, was rooted in an ideological innovation which invested the useful arts with a significance beyond mere utility. Technology had come to be identified with transcendence, implicated as never before in the Christian idea of redemption. The worldly means of survival were now redirected toward the otherworldly end of salvation. Thus, the emergence of Western technology as a historic force and the emergence of the religion of technology were two sides of the same phenomenon. I'm flipping through to just pick out highlights and quotes that stood out to me as I focus on a lot. In my recent book, here he mentioned the Reformers' emphasis upon the literal interpretation of Scripture, moreover, together with the development and spread of printing technology, made the prophetic books of the Bible and hence apocalyptic speculation more accessible. So that's going back to the 1450s or so with Gutenberg's printing press, which is like the modern internet. Made the prophetic books of the Bible and hence apocalyptic speculation more accessible. So the printing press technology then spread much of the literature and the consciousness of this whole apocalyptic millennialism, redemption, transcendence, and that, you know, came what a lot of people were going to school with and what people were studying. So it sort of follows logically that that's what they would aspire to. The great English historian Trevelyan estimated that the effect of the continual domestic study of the book upon the national character, imagination, and intelligence was greater than any literary movement in our annals or any religious movement since the coming of Augustine. Indeed, in the 17th century, a literal reading of the Bible, in particular the prophetic books of the Old Testament and the book of Revelation of the New Testament, became central to all arts, sciences, and literatures. So there's an example of how the literature gets infused into various ramifications. Another one mentioned over and over was Daniel, the book of Daniel or something, Daniel's Revelations. So if you want to look that up, you can find out how that influenced all these the technology and the inventions. But one of the interesting connections with the Freemasons was what he calls a brotherhood of the Sons of Adam, the Freemasons. So these various organizations, if you follow the, you know, what their religious associations are, where their lineage is, it gives a clue as to what is motivating them. And here's a quote, power machinery became in there, the steam engine they came fervently to believe would further advance that grand and growing cooperation in the far time of the millennium. Power machinery became in their eyes a god of the state of bliss, something to be worshipped. Another millennium in America, the millennium seemed about to begin. This then was the ideological context of technological development in America, where scientific and industrial revolutions followed in the wake of religious revival. Premillennialists earnestly anticipated the piously prepared for Christ's imminent return and the start of the millennium. And then here he lists, like with NASA, he lists how like 90% of NASA at a certain point were Protestants. Here he lists that the Masons have been among the most prominent pioneers of every American transportation revolution. And he lists the names that go with canals, steamboats, railroads, the automobile, Henry Ford, the airplane, Charles Lindbergh, and spaceflight. At least half a dozen astronauts, including John Glenn, the first man to orbit the Earth, and Edwin Aldrin, lunar module pilot for the first landing on the moon. And here we have millenarian Protestants who gave America its defining myth rooted in the providential promise of new beginnings. The American myth saw life and history as just beginning. Walt Whitman referred to it as the new world. That's my input there. R.W.B. Lewis suggested it is described the world as starting up again under fresh initiative and a divinely granted second chance for the human race. The hero of the myth was a new Adam. An individual emancipated from history and easily identified with Adam before the fall. Here, progress toward perfection was at the same time the recovery of primitive Adamic perfection. The American was the eternal Adam who would create an earthly millennium of perfect harmony in the new world Eden. I, chanter of Adamic songs through the new garden, the West, waxed Walt Whitman. Divine am I, inside and out, and I make holy whatever I touch. And there's my issue with Walt Whitman. It's lofty poetry, but he makes holy whatever he touched, but he does not. Where's the acknowledgement that it was already holy and that the native people were already here living in harmony and caregiving for whatever that was touched? So there's the flip-flop of this whole religiosity as waxing for the new this and the new that, and that's the fault. That's where I see the main fault and what this book is pointing out in an enlightening way. This then was the ideological context of technological development in America, where scientific and industrial revolutions followed in the wake of religious revival. There will also doubtless be great improvements and advances made in all those mechanic arts by which the earth will be subdued and cultivated. There's the gist of the problem. Technologically, the paradise was based upon the useful harnessing of the powers of nature, the wind and waves, the tides and heat of the sun, the technical means. And that goes fast forward to the greenwashing, where the solar and wind power are being touted, but then again, it's not looked into where those come from and what the side effects are. So I think some of the gists are this whole, what is the obsession with the recovery of perfection and what are we actually working towards or what is already here? And that the trajectory away from working with Mother Earth has them obsessed, grandiosity for humanity. Here's the quote. The pace of evolutionary change consequently will be extremely rapid. The advent of artificial life will be the most significant historical event since the emergence of human beings. This will be a landmark event in the history of Earth and possibly the entire universe. With the advent of artificial life, we may be the first species to create its own successors, Farmer emphasized. and then Noble writes, and with a paternal sensibility reminiscent of Victor Frankenstein, he described mankind's mathematical progeny, quote, "What will these successors be like? If we fail in our task as creators, they may indeed be cold and malevolent. However, if we succeed, they may be glorious, enlightened creatures that far surpass us in their intelligence and wisdom. It is quite possible that when the conscious beings of the future look back on this era, we will be most noteworthy not in and of ourselves, but rather for what we gave rise to. Artificial life is potentially the most beautiful creation of humanity." So that's where I laugh out loud, because that artificial life, it's right there in the words. Artificial life could be the most beautiful creation of humanity. But what about looking across the room at a fellow human being and saying, "You and your hair and the flower you're holding are the most beautiful natural life creation of God, spirit, whatever you want to call it." So I'll leave it on that note. Thank you for listening. Have a good one and be well.